I come back. After all of these preparations, today we're going to solve the Einstein equations for a cosmological scenario, for the so-called Friedmann-Lemaître cosmological space-times. And we're using the elegant methods that we have developed so far, which means that we will essentially do this without choosing a coordinate system. We start with the experimental evidence. The experimental evidence is that the universe is and has been expanding. That was discovered by Hubble. And it appears from the experimental evidence that the universe is essentially spatially isotropic and homogeneous. Isotropic means looks the same in all directions, and homogeneous means looks the same everywhere. Now, if you just look out the universe, it doesn't appear that way, because you see the Milky Way in the sky, and, well, that's not isotropic or homogeneous. But on large scales, the universe is isotropic and homogeneous, and by large scales, what is meant is at scales from about 3 billion light years onwards. If you average over that sort of length scale, then it's pretty much homogeneous and isotropic there. So even on that scale, there are some, you know, big walls and holes, voids, and so on. But it's a good approximation to say that from about that scale of about 3 billion light years, it's pretty much equally distributed what is there, and the space-time itself is also behaving in an isotropic homogeneous way. So therefore, for the purpose of describing the universe at that sort of length scale and larger, it is a good idealizing model to assume that we have perfect spatial isotropy and perfect homogeneity. Later, of course, we will have to consider the case that it's not quite that. But for now, let's make this simplifying assumption. And that then leads to the models that are named after Friedmann and Lemaître, and later Robertson and Walker also worked on these. Concretely, these experimental observations we translate into these mathematical idealizations. First of all, we idealize this by saying that the space-time is just a direct product of a time and a space, in the sense that I is an interval of the real line, or also the entire real line, as the case may be, but it's just one-dimensional. And then we have a three-dimensional manifold that describes space. So we can separate cleanly time and space. And the metric we then therefore write as minus dt squared plus some potential scale factor times g bar. And so now we have two metrics here. We have the metric without a g, which is the space-time metric. And we have g with a bar over it that describes the metric of just the spatial part. Pick a time, and then we have a space. And the metric in that space, sigma, is g bar. And there will be other barred quantities further below. So the actual space-time metric has a scale factor multiplying that spatial metric. So that spatial metric doesn't give us the actual distances. They just describe the basic geometry of that spatial part up to a scaling. So this is the ansatz that Friedmann, Lemaître, and Robertson and Walker made. And with this ansatz, you can then try to solve the Einstein equations, and that's what we will do today. This time variable here, t, with without any prefactor there, that's what is called the cosmic time. That's the time you would measure on your wristwatch if you just go with the flow of the universe, with the expansion, if you don't have any peculiar velocity, if you're not moving against the fixed sky background, if you're just floating, which essentially we do. We move, our galaxy moves with a speed of like a few hundreds of kilometers per second. The Earth goes around the Sun at about 25 kilo, 27 kilometers a second, but the entire galaxy is moving at a few hundred kilometers a second, which is slow compared to the speed of light. And so essentially we are freely floating inertial observers in the overall scheme of the expansion of the universe. So essentially this is our wristwatch time. It's also called cosmic time. And A is called the scale factor function. So what we assume here is, because of the observation of isotropy and homogeneity at large scales, which we idealize to be isotropy and homogeneity at all scales, we assume that this spatial part, this spatial manifold, is fully isotropic and homogeneous, and that it is a Riemannian manifold, not a Lorentzian. It's a Riemannian manifold because this is just describing the spatial part. There's no time mixed into it. The time is separated out. The total metric has, of course, a Lorentzian signature, but the metric on sigma alone, on the spatial part alone, doesn't have a time component in it. It's a positive definite metric. And so what we have is a fully isotropic and homogeneous Riemannian manifold. That is to say, a manifold, a Riemannian manifold of constant curvature. Which means that at every point in time, we have a three-dimensional so-called surface of homogeneity. Of course, surface is to be understood as a three-dimensional thing now, because space-time is four-dimensional, and we hold a point in time fixed, then what we are left with is a three-dimensional manifold, and that three-dimensional manifold we assume to be of constant curvature. Now, we're not making that assumption that the curvature is zero. We're just making the assumption it's constant. The reason is that you can have homogeneity and isotropy even if there's curvature, as long as that curvature is constant. Because then you can travel as far as you want, universe looks the same. You can look in all directions as you want, universe looks the same. So just saying that it's isotropic and homogeneous doesn't mean that it's not curved. It's just that it can be curved only in a very special way. So let's classify that. What could it be then? What are the possible Riemannian manifolds of constant curvature? That is to say, the possible Riemannian manifolds that are that have full isotropy and homogeneity. Later in this course, we will weaken this assumption and allow partial isotropy, partial homogeneity, because we can't be so sure that it's entirely homogeneous and isotropic, and it turns out that what we do today can also be done to some extent if we lower the assumption of symmetry. We don't have to use full isotropy and homogeneity to be able to solve the Einstein equations. In fact, the former chair of the Applied Math Department here wrote a book with Ellis on exact solutions, which typically are solutions in the context of cosmology, these are solutions where you weaken the assumptions of isotropy and homogeneity, and then you can still solve the Einstein equation. But here we still have this full assumption. What constant curvature manifolds are there? Well, given the symmetries of the Riemann curvature tensor, namely the symmetry that it has anti-symmetry in the last two indices, anti-symmetry in the first two indices, and symmetry with respect to exchanging the first two indices with the last two indices, if all the four indices are down, that allows us to fix, to know beforehand what the possible expressions for the Riemann curvature tensor are. And remember, this thing has a bar because it's a Riemann curvature tensor for just the spatial part, for just the sigma. So it is a number which describes the curvature times this product and difference of metrics. You see, since the Riemann curvature tensor in the manifold of constant curvature can only depend on a scalar, on a number, we know that that number has to be in front of all of it. And then the index structure forces that the Riemann curvature tensor is expressed in this way in terms of the metrics. You see, there is no other tensor that we could use to describe a Riemann curvature tensor without breaking the symmetry of it all. The only canonical tensor that we have available is the metric, so it has to be expressible in terms of the metric and in terms of this combination. If you look at it, if you exchange KL for IJ, the whole thing is symmetric because it's all in here and in here. If you change the KL, then you exchange the role of the two, so it's anti-symmetric. If you exchange I and J, you're also exchanging the role, so it's anti-symmetric. So this fixes it. And then we can contract with respect to the IK indices to obtain the Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor is therefore 2K of the metric. And then we contract the Ricci tensor and we get the Ricci scalar. Now notice that we used here that if you contract the metric with itself, then you get a factor of 3 because it's a three-dimensional spatial space-time, I mean space, curved space. Okay, so that's good. Now let's use a triad. Remember we had tetrads. Tetrads were orthonormal bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces. In four-dimensional space-time, in three-dimensional space, you can also do that, but then you have only three, and the term that we use then is dreibein or triad. And we denote these basis vectors, these orthonormal basis vectors, then with a theta bar. Remember, this is all space here because we are just describing here this sigma, and therefore all the quantities have bars over them. So once we have the Riemann curvature tensor, we can declare these two indices here, which are anti-symmetric, as being a two-form. And so we obtain the curvature two-form. And it's this one, right? So we just contract with those two indices, this, and then we can suppress the writing of these two indices, and we obtain the curvature two-form. So the curvature two-form is just k, this constant there, times theta I bar and veg theta j bar. Then we can ask, what's the role of the sine of this constant k? In principle, it could be positive, zero, or negative. Well, if k is larger than zero, then we have a spacetime of constant positive curvature. And that means that sigma is a three-dimensional sphere. So it's not a sphere in three dimensions. It's a three-dimensional sphere. So it's a three-dimensional object itself, which could be embedded, for example, in a four-dimensional space. It doesn't have to be, but it could be. This would mean that we are having a universe which is closed and of finite volume. At every point in time, it would be a finite volume, even though the volume could change, because the actual metric has the G bar built into it, but there's also a scale factor. So the actual volume can change. So we would have a closed universe with the property that if you fly with the spaceship straight for a long time, you come back to where you started, no matter in which direction you go. The same as if you lived on a two-dimensional sphere embedded in three dimensions. You travel any direction, you come back to where you started. This would be the case here. So it would be looking to us as if the universe was periodic in every direction. For k equal to zero, we have a universe which spatially doesn't have any curvature. It could still have curvature between space and time, and as we will soon see, curvature between space and time is expansion or shrinkage. But here we're just describing the spatial part, and if the curvature scalar is equal to zero, well then we don't have curvature. And instead, our space sigma, our space manifold sigma, is simply Euclidean R3. So the angle sum in triangles is pi, and Pythagoras holds true, and so on and so on. We seem to be pretty close to this experimentally. And then k could also be negative. Now, if k is negative, then we have a manifold of negative curvature everywhere, remember, because this is a homogeneous isotropic spacetime, which means that if we want to visualize that, the closest to this is that we consider a surface in two dimensions, embedded in three dimensions, a surface where we there have negative curvature. And that would be, for example, a saddle, right? At the saddle point, we have negative curvature. And so this would be a manifold which is everywhere, in three dimensions, everywhere like a saddle. Such universes are infinite in size. So only the positive curvature ones are of finite volume. These two are of infinite volume. Remember that the curvature tensor can be expressed in terms of second derivatives of the metric. And therefore, the curvature tensor has units of 1 over length squared. And if it is, as we saw here, proportional to k, and the metric itself doesn't have units, then the k has units. And in principle, we can always choose units such that the k is either plus 1, minus 1, or 0. And that's the convention in cosmology, that we simply speak of k plus 1, minus 1, or 0, assuming that we choose our units such that this turns out. And of course, you can't change units such that a positive one becomes a negative or a 0. So we have a triad for the space. And in the simplest case, this could be, just to visualize it, what these theta I's could be. Let's say k is equal to 0. Then everything is familiar because it's R3. So the standard space here is R3. And by standard, I mean, well, you know, there's a scale factor in front of it. So at every point in time, the thing can be stretched compared to before or after. But the standard space is simply having no curvature at all, spatial curvature at all. It's just R3. And an orthonormal frame would just be the dx1, dx2, dx3. Right? So it would be very simple in this case. But you could also do local Lorentz transformations, and then with arbitrary functions, then it would be arbitrarily complicated. You can also use positive and negative curvature ones. But you see, we don't need to choose any coordinate systems here. We're just using the fact that we know that we can choose orthonormal frames. And so we just assume an orthonormal frame to be chosen. But what coordinate system we use doesn't really matter. So now let's calculate a tetrad for the space-time. And by coordinate system, I meant now coordinate system just on the spatial part. Because for the space-time part, we've made a choice that time is separate, right? OK, so now that we dealt with the spatial curvature and described it all in terms of a tetrad, and we also have the curvature tensor here, let us now look at a tetrad for space-time, for the whole thing. Remember, the metric is given in this way. And now we define a convenient tetrad, that is to say an O(n) basis for each tangent space of the full space-time manifold. And we choose theta naught to be dt for convenience, and the theta I to be a of t theta bar of I. And keep in mind that the theta bar I are chosen to be a triad with respect to just the spatial manifold sigma. So they are orthonormal with respect to the metric g bar. The theta I, on the other hand, have this extra scale factor here. So the theta I would not be orthonormal with respect to the g bar metric, but they are orthonormal with respect to the g metric. right? Because the G matrix requires that exact factor here, the A in there. So now what we will do is we will use this frame and we will calculate all the ingredients needed for the Einstein equation so that we can then solve the Einstein equation. And what will we need? What will we need? Well, once we have the frame, we should be able to calculate the torsion and the curvature and the affine connection. Well, we're assuming that there is no torsion. That's great. That gives us an extra equation. The torsion freeness gives us an extra equation. So what we will do is we will calculate the affine connection, that is to say the connection one form, and then from that we can calculate the curvature tensor, and from that we get the Einstein tensor, and then we find out about the energy momentum tensor, we can write down the Einstein equation and solve it. All that without having to make difficult choices of coordinate system and then solving things in coordinate systems. Okay, so the first step is that we calculate the connection one form. What do we have to, what can we work with? Remember, we have the first and second structure equation. The first structure equation expresses the torsion in terms of the frame. Remember that the frame contains all the information we want, right? So we can calculate the torsion from it. And the first structure equation is the definition of the torsion. And the second structure equation is the definition of the curvature, or the curvature tensor. Here we have torsionless space, a torsionless space time. So therefore, the first structure equation is that the torsion is equal to zero, which is to say that this expression is equal to zero. If we did not make the assumption of torsion freeness, then this would be the torsion tensor here, the torsion two form. See, this is a two form. This is a one form. The D of it is a two form. And here we have a one form, and here we have a one form. The whole thing is a two form, and it would be the torsion two form, but we're setting it equal to zero. Now, we actually have two first structure equations, and we have two second structure equations, because we have the full space-time manifold, which has its structure equations, and we have the spatial part of it, the sigma, which also has its structure equations. And we can use both of them, we will need to use both of them, to infer what the connection one form is. So we start with the first structure equation. First structure equation is this one, and on sigma, and it is this equation on the full space-time manifold M. So capital M, remember, is the full space-time manifold. Sigma is just the spatial standard space-time. So in order to calculate the four connection, the connection one form on the entire space-time, we start by calculating d theta I in two different ways, essentially using this or using that. So the d theta I is d of, well, theta I is a times theta bar, so it's d of a theta bar. And that is the d of a by the Leibniz rule, d of a carrying forward the theta bar plus carrying forward the a and externally differentiating the theta bar. Now, let's see, what can we do here? We have here dA, and we can write the dA as dA by dt dt. So we're just carrying this forward, writing the dA as dA by dt, and then undoing this by writing dt. And for this expression, we use the first structure equation here. We have that d theta bar is this. So we plug that in here. We obtain the d theta bar is this. I mean, up to a minus sign, right? We have to put this on the other side. And there's a prefactor of a. Now, to go from here to here, we notice that dA by dt can be written as a dot. And dt, well, that's just theta naught, because we chose theta naught to be the dt. So we can write it in this form. Also, a times the theta bar is the theta, is the frame vector in the full space time. So we can replace a theta bar by theta here. Now, from that line, we just carry forward this term. But here we do a little trick. We say that a dot is the same as a dot times a divided by a. Right? So we multiply by a and divide by a. Okay, so we have an a in a numerator, a in a denominator. The a in a numerator, we can multiply with this theta bar and get a theta. So we turn this into theta naught theta I and a dot over a. I also switch the sequence of these two so that we get a minus sign here. So the whole thing has minus here, minus there. Remember, this is anti-symmetric. So that's one way of calculating what d theta I is, namely by using the definition of the theta I in terms of the theta I bar, and then using the first structure equation. But we also have the second structure equation. We can directly say d theta I using the first structure equation on the full spacetime manifold, and we can write it like this. Notice, I should have said this earlier, that when I use Latin indices, they only run from 1 to 3. The Greek indices run from 0 to 3. So we are calculating here the d theta i, so I is 1, 2, or 3. So using the first structure equation on the entire manifold, we get that d theta I is minus of this. So it's here. And that has the I here, which runs from 1 to 3, but the new runs from 0 to 3. And we can write this as two terms, one term where we have the 0, 0 here, and another term where we have the j, j. OK, so we have calculated d theta I in two different ways and obtained that d theta I is this, but it's also that. And now we can compare. And when we compare that, we see that this must be that. So therefore, the a dot over a theta I has to be this. So the a dot over a theta I is the omega I naught. And then from here, we recognize that the omega ij has to be the omega bar ij. So interestingly, the connection one form for the space-space parts are the same on the just spatial part and on the space-time manifold. Whereas we see that the connection one form, the connection as far as space and time is concerned, where we have a zero here, so time, and here space, the connection one form for that is actually non-trivial. And that's the first indication already that in an expanding space-time, we have curvature between space and time. So even if the spatial part was just constant curvature, and let's say that curvature is 0, so k equal to 0, we would still have this. We would still have non-trivial curvature between space and time. So now that we have the connection one form, we can calculate the curvature two form. And remember, while the first structure equation expresses the torsion in terms of the connection one form, namely torsion equal to this, this second structure equation expresses the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form. So we have the second structure equation, and we have two of them, one on the entire space-time manifold and one just on the spatial space. So what we have is, if we choose, for example, just the space-space part, for the space-space part, we obtain by just carrying this forward, this expression here from the second structure equation, and we can now use that we calculated what the connection one form is. So in particular, we have here the omega ij, and we know that's the same as the omega bar ij, because for the space-space components, the connection one form is the same for just the spatial part and the space-time part. And here we have two terms. We have a term where the mu is equal to zero, and we have a term where the mu is, you know, running 1, 2, 3. Now, first the term where this is spatial, mu is 1, 2, 3, that's this term. And we can just place the bars over this because, as we just said, the space-space components of the connection one form do not distinguish between, they're the same for the full space-time and for just the spatial manifold. So that's, we get this. But then we also have these components where there is a zero involved. We have this here. And therefore, we get this thing twice. So first of all, what we have is that this expression we can now recognize as the curvature 2 form on just the spatial manifold. Because this has all the bars, this has all the bars. So therefore, the omega ij of the space-time, the full curvature 2 form of the full space-time, is given by the curvature 2 form of just the spatial part, plus this remnant here. Now, the curvature 2 form of the full space-time is, as we saw earlier, just k times theta bar I veg theta bar j. And since we calculated here what these theta bar, we calculated the connection one form here, and we can plug that now into here, where we needed the zero and space components. We carry this forward over to here, and we obtain that the full curvature 2 form is given by k over a squared times this, where the 1 over a squared arose from expressing the barred thetas, spatial thetas, in terms of the unbarred ones, using this over here. Oh, you can't see the bar here. Right, so the barred ones are the unbarred ones divided by a. That's why we get here a k over a squared, and then we can write here the thetas. So the full curvature 2 form is given by that expression plus this expression coming from that term which we got from here. So therefore, the full curvature 2 form takes this form here, where we see that it has, I mean, the full curvature 2 form for the space-space components. And we see that it has two contributions. One is from the intrinsic curvature that comes from the spatial manifold alone, possibly having its own intrinsic definition of constant curvature. That was the k. And then because we translated this into the full space-time curvature, where the metric has an a squared factor in front of the spatial part that's divided by a squared here. But we also have an extra term contributing to the curvature two-form space-space components, which is a dot squared over a squared. That's a contribution to the space part of the curvature that arises from the expansion itself. By a similar method, using the second structure equations for the spatial part and the space-time, we can also calculate the zero I components of the Riemann curvature 2 form. And it comes out to be this. I leave it to you as an exercise if you wish to just redo this calculation for the zero I components. You will obtain that. So now we have the full curvature 2 form. Remember that it's symmetric in these two indices, so we also get the omega I naught component in this way. So then we can calculate the Einstein tensor, and we obtain rewriting the Einstein tensor, writing the curvature 2 form in terms of the curvature tensor, so just making it explicit again that we suppress two indices here. We can write this as in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor, and we can read off all the components of the Riemann curvature tensor from having the curvature 2 form. Now that's completely straightforward to do, so I won't go into the details. We can do that, it's a little exercise. The point is that if you then read off what the entries are of the full curvature tensor, you can then contract it and obtain the Ricci tensor, and then contract it one more time and you get the curvature scalar. Having the Ricci tensor and the curvature scalar, we obtain the Einstein tensor. And the Einstein tensor is, of course, what we are after, because that's going to be the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And these expressions that we have up here enter then, of course, into what the Einstein tensor is. And here's what we obtain. We obtain, first of all, that it is diagonal. The Einstein tensor is diagonal, so it's zero whenever mu is not equal to nu. And on the diagonal, we have that the 0,0 component is this expression. Notice that there's a k over a squared here. And that term would be absent if the spatial part of the universe is flat, k equals 0. And then we also have the space-space diagonal components, and they are a slightly different expression, but they also contain a k over a squared. Now, since the Einstein tensor is diagonal, we know that the energy momentum tensor also has to be diagonal, because the energy momentum tensor, according to the Einstein equation, is proportional to the Einstein tensor, the proportionality factor being 8 pi g. So T mu nu in cosmology, at least under the assumption of isotropy and homogeneity, T mu nu must also be diagonal. So if we take the observation that the universe is approximately isotropic and homogeneous, looks the same in all directions, and also looks the same everywhere, then we've just derived that the Einstein tensor has to take this form and the energy momentum tensor has to be diagonal. Now, when the energy momentum tensor is diagonal, then we can write it in this form and we can interpret it, if only as a matter of language, as the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. I'll come back to that in a moment. For now, let's just write it as a diagonal tensor. So the 0,0 component is the energy density, and then the spatial components are the pressure. The pressures have to be the same in all directions because the GII is the same in all directions. It doesn't have an I dependent. Also, we can allow for a cosmological constant. Since we did not, by choice, include a cosmological constant here on the part of the Einstein tensor, we might as well add the cosmological constant as part of the energy momentum tensor. But if we do, then we follow the convention of saying that the energy momentum tensor is given by the matter energy density and pressure, and then minus 1 over 8 pi g cosmological constant times the metric. And why this convention? Well, it's because if we throw this on the other side of the Einstein equation, then that's just making up for that factor of 8 pi g. Remember the Einstein equation here? G mu nu is 8 pi g t mu nu. Right? So if the cosmological constant is added here negatively and divided by 8 pi g, it's the same as if we added it positively without a prefactor on the left-hand side. But let's look at what it does if we write the cosmological constant on the right-hand side. First of all, we can add it because it doesn't spoil what we just discovered, namely that the energy momentum tensor has to be diagonal. The cosmological constant contributes a diagonal term to the energy momentum tensor. And how does it contribute, viewed in this way, viewed not as part of the curvature part, as adding to the Einstein, tensor, but instead, if we view the cosmological constant as we do here, as contributing to the energy momentum tensor, then how does it contribute? Well, what we see is that we have here a minus, and then up here a minus, which means that the positive cosmological constant is positively contributing to the energy density, right? Because it's minus, and then here's a minus one. So a positive cosmological constant contributes overall positively to the energy density. But what about the pressure? Well, the pressure has no such luck here. It is positive, but still negative here. So a positive cosmological constant subtracts from the pressure. It lowers the pressure. One might shrug this off and say, well, why not? Let it reduce the pressure. But the point is, the cosmological constant could be large. It could be so large that it completely undoes that pressure and turns it negative. Which means that you now have an energy momentum tensor which has a positive energy density but a negative pressure. And then we have to wonder, what does the negative pressure do? How does this affect the evolution of the universe? Okay, so from isotropy and homogeneity, we derived that the Einstein tensor takes this form, therefore the energy momentum tensor must take this form. And notice that here we made no assumption about what is contributing here to the energy density, other than, well, it could also be the cosmological constant. But overall, the only parameters that we have that describe the energy momentum tensor are just the energy density and the pressure. And in the future, we will just consider the cosmological constant to be part of the energy momentum tensor, not to be added to it, but part of it. And then we will just speak of the energy density and the pressure, and the impact of the cosmological constant is already built in to what we mean by the energy density and the pressure. So the only thing that we care about here for the cosmological purpose is, what's the energy density? What's the pressure? We don't care about any other quantum numbers that matter might have. We don't care whether this is fermions or bosons, this species, that species. We don't even care whether it's a cosmological constant. The only thing that matters is, what's the energy density? What's the pressure? And instead of working with equations of motion, such as the Dirac equation, the Maxwell equation, and so on, in cosmology, we often simply make the assumption that we know how energy density and pressure are related to each other. So for example, for dust, there is no pressure, because these dust particles are assumed to be sufficiently far apart that they never bump into each other. And there's no pressure. We just have there's an energy density. For radiation, for example, for the electromagnetic field, if you just have some black body radiation of the electromagnetic field, such as the cosmic microwave background, then you can also calculate what is the relationship between pressure and energy density. And it turns out that the pressure is a third of the energy density for electromagnetic radiation. Anyway, so the point is that for cosmology, we don't usually need to know exactly what the matter does. What we need to know about it is, what is its energy density and what's the pressure? And that includes here the the contributions include also the cosmological constant. And remember, we previously already encountered the relationship between pressure and energy density, namely pressure divided by energy density was the W parameter, the equation of state parameter. Equation of state, because in thermodynamics, if you have an ideal gas, then you can write down a relationship between energy density and pressure. So let's ask, what kind of matter produces such a diagonal energy momentum tensor? And as I already discussed here, a perfect fluid would, but it doesn't mean that the universe has to be full of a perfect fluid. There can also be other contributions. For example, the electromagnetic field can produce this. Also, a scalar field can produce contributions there. The point is that if the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, it just has to have this general form. So now, let's see what the statement that it is a perfect fluid boils down to mathematically. Remember that the statement that the T mu nu is diagonal and describable by a perfect fluid is the statement that the energy momentum tensor actually is not only diagonal, but can be written in this form, where we have some time-like vector, time-like vector mu mu, and the energy momentum tensor takes this form. And here we can actually do this. To see this, we kind of had this before in a previous lecture, but let's reconsider that. So let's consider the dual vector to the theta naught. Theta naught is dt, and the dual vector is d by dt, of course, right? Because they just eat each other up to give you a 1 and a 0 with all the other basis vectors. So the dual vector to theta naught is called e naught, and it is d by dt. So let's define this time-like vector field u, which is just the e naught. And we can write this as u mu e mu, where we only have one non-zero component, namely the u naught is 1 and all the other components are 0. So we have a time-like vector field that has the components 1, 0, 0, 0. And that time-like vector field is this one, it's this, it's d by dt. And then if you just plug that in, you find that this expression becomes that. You just plug that in. And there's even an interpretation for this, namely, the U is actually a geodesic here. It is as if you have a particle of this perfect fluid. This could be our galaxy, and it's just geodesically moving. Let's just briefly prove that this time-like vector field is indeed a geodesic. So for that, we have to calculate the covariant derivative of U in the direction of U, which is to say the covariant derivative of E naught in the direction of E naught. And the affine connection can be evaluated using the connection 1 form. So we take the connection 1 form and plug into its 1 slot, because it's a 1 form, the E naught. And then we obtain from, remember we had this up here, what the connection 1 form is. Here, we calculated the connection 1 form. If you have a 0 component here, then the 0i component has a theta I there. So we have here the theta I evaluated on the E naught, but since they are a dual basis, and this is an I, a space index, and it's a time index, they evaluate to 0, so this is 0. So this vector field, covariantly differentiated in its own direction, is 0. So it's a geodesic. So now that we know about the energy momentum tensor, we can write down the Einstein equation. Einstein equation here now consists on the left-hand side of the terms that we had up here. And on the right-hand side, we have the energy momentum tensor in terms of the pressure and the energy density. In principle, these are 16 equations, but it's diagonal. So therefore, it's only four equations, but all the space parts are the same. The space-space parts are the same. So we really only get one equation for mu and nu equal to 0 and 0, and another equation where they are I and I. And the first one for 0, 0 is this one, the energy equation, from the energy density. And that is a famous equation called the Friedmann equation. And then we have, in principle, just as important, the II component equation, which is this one. And as we saw before, we can confirm again that the energy in the energy equation, we recognize that here's the energy density, and here's the cosmological constant. And we see that the cosmological constant is able to mimic a positive energy density. It is contributing to the Friedmann equation, to the 0-0 component of the Einstein equation, exactly the same way as if there was a larger energy density. And the space-space components have this equation where there is no dependence on the energy density, but the pressure is here. Right? That's P, the pressure. And now we see that the cosmological constant simultaneously mimics a negative pressure. If this is large, it will turn the pressure negative. Now, it turns out that these two equations have a term in common, which we can use to eliminate that term, namely the k dependence. We have here k over a squared, and here we have minus k over a squared. Here we have k over a squared times 3, and here we have minus k over a squared. So let's eliminate this expression by solving both equations for this and then setting that equal. Or we just solve one of them and then substitute it into the other. That's what we do here. We take a third of the first equation and add the second equation, multiply the whole thing with minus 1/2 a. And then we obtain that the second derivative of the scale factor, so the acceleration of the expansion of the universe, is given by that expression. Or more neatly, by this expression here in the box. And what we see here is that if there was no cosmological constant, this is super important, if there was no cosmological constant, then as long as we have matter with a positive energy density and positive pressure, and ordinary matter always has positive pressure, or zero pressure perhaps, but not negative, so if for ordinary matter, this would be positive. And we would see the universality of gravitational attraction here. Because no matter what this value is, if it's positive, as it should be for ordinary matter, well, then that entire expression is negative, which means the universe decelerates. So no matter what the universe is filled with, if it's ordinary matter that has positive pressure and positive energy density, then the acceleration is negative. So after the Big Bang, the universe might continue to accelerate, but the acceleration slows down. So a dot is the velocity of the acceleration, and a double dot is, a double dot is the acceleration. If that's negative, it means gravity puts the brakes on it. And a cosmological constant could change that, because that thing could be negative, negative enough to turn this sign around. And then the universe might be expanding, expanding in an accelerated way. In principle, this could also be achieved without a cosmological constant if we could come up with a kind of matter that has a P that's small enough and negative and sufficiently negative, right? But we don't know of any of that. So what's the experimental evidence? There have been detailed, precise observations of supernova distance versus supernova brightness, and also evidence from measuring the cosmic microwave background radiation, and Nobel Prizes have been given for these results, that have found that, in fact, the universe is accelerating now and has been for billions of years. In fact, it seems that the lambda is large enough so that it turns around a negative sign, so that, you know, the A double dot is positive instead of negative. So it seems that the lambda is large enough that it really dominates this in a big way, namely that the overall energy density, the energy density that includes the cosmological constant, the full energy density, is about 70% cosmological constant. And only about 30% matter of some kind, of which 90% we don't know what it is. Right? So we see only little of what contributes to the energy momentum tensor. By far most seems to be a contribution from a cosmological constant, which is why it is dominating here and flips the sign. So it is as if you added something negative in here, or actually it's positive, but since this is negative, it's overwhelming that. So 70% of the total energy density, let me just put it this way, 70% of the total zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor is a cosmological constant or something that masquerades as a cosmological constant, and then only 30% is matter, of which most is dark matter. Now, if you look at this equation here, without solving it explicitly, we can already make a prediction, which is that in the future, the energy density is going to diminish because, you know, whatever is in the universe is going to be diluted. Whether this is gas clouds, galaxies, electromagnetic fields, they're going to be diluted. So the energy density is going to be diluted, going to go down, and so does the pressure, because with an expansion, the pressure goes down, which means that that contribution becomes smaller and smaller, which means this being a constant, the lambda is a constant, will become more and more dominant over time. And we might, just to see what that implies, set this equal to zero already and just say, what is it going to do in the far future when this becomes negligible compared to that? Well, then we have to solve this differential equation, right? From the Friedmann equation, let me just show you here. We say that the rho is small, and then we have this differential equation here. 3 times a dot over a squared, 3 times a dot over a squared plus a k over a squared equal 2. And then we neglect this, and then we get just the lambda, and then we can solve the differential equation. You could also solve this one. It doesn't really matter. It's easy to solve. And what you find is that depending on what the curvature is of the spatial manifold, you get these evolutions. Namely, for k equal to 0, so if space, at every point in time, space is just flat, it's a flat R3, then a universe that's dominated in its evolution by the cosmological constant experiences exponential expansion. So that's clearly accelerated as exponential expansion. If the universe is, however, spatially, at every point in time, at every point in cosmological time, it is a three-dimensional sphere, then it evolves like the hyperbolic cosine. And if it is a hyperbolic space, so if it's negative curvature, then it evolves like the hyperbolic sine. And you might think, okay, so not exponentially. Well, they are exponential too, right? If you just write out what the hyperbolic cosine is and hyperbolic sine, they are the sum of a growing exponential and a decaying exponential. And soon the growing exponential, which has the same coefficient as just an exponential, the growing, it's not like it's quadratic or anything. So the growing exponential takes over. So for large t, it's exponential no matter what. This means that independently of whether the space-time is positively or negatively or not at all curved in space, a positive cosmological constant that dominates the evolution leads to exponential expansion. So this is what the negative pressure does. And negative pressure originating in the cosmological constant. So let's now look for a solution strategy with the cosmological constant and matter. Overall, what do we have? We have three unknown functions of time. The scale factor, which definitely is the most interesting part, but also how does the energy density evolve in time? How does the pressure evolve in time? We're expecting that those two go down and the scale factor goes up. And we have for these three unknown functions, three equations of motion that they obey. And what are these equations? Well, we have equations A and B, which were the two Einstein equations here, the 0,0 component and the II component. So we have these two equations. And we have also the assumption of an equation that relates the pressure and the energy density. So this is the input that we make about what the matter does. In principle, we should say, oh, we have matter that's made out of quarks and W and Z bosons and photons and all sorts of neutrinos and electrons and so on. And then write down all of the equations of motion and then solve them. But instead of doing that, what we will say for cosmological purposes, well, at the end of the day, what matters for gravity is what they do in the energy momentum tensor. And at the end of the day, what they do in the energy momentum tensor is induce some relationship between energy density and pressure. And we know what would happen if there was no matter at all and no radiation, but only a cosmological constant. If there is only a cosmological constant, then the pressure as a function of the energy density is simply the pressure is minus the energy density. And remember that? It's because of this, right? If there was none of this, if the energy momentum tensor consists only of the cosmological constant, then we have that the energy density is positive because there's a minus sign, right? And the pressure is the same thing, but negative. So therefore, the ratio of pressure over energy density is just minus one, right? Because they just differ by a sign, that's all. So we know that if there is no if there is no matter or radiation involved, then it's easy to describe what's going on. Namely, the pressure as a function of the energy density is simply minus the energy density. OK, So in this case, we can say we have two differential equations to solve, namely the Einstein equations A and B up there. And we have this equation. So we have three equations to solve. This one, the relationship between energy density and pressure, and the two Einstein equations for the three variables, A of t, rho of t, P of t. And essentially, we just did this because we calculated what the evolution is for A of t in the simple case where the matter is negligible. Another important case is the case shortly after the Big Bang. After inflation ended, we will get to this in much more detail later on, where the universe was initially filled with hot radiation, hot plasma. In the case where the universe is filled with just pure radiation, so where the rest masses of particles are negligible or zero, as compared to the energy that is just in the radiation, in that case, one can prove that the pressure is a third of the energy density. I mentioned that before, right, for the electromagnetic radiation. So if, for example, we are interested in a phase, an epoch in the evolution of the universe, where the universe was filled with a hot plasma that was dominating everything else, that was larger than the cosmological constant, and larger than the contribution from the rest masses of particles, larger than anything else. If the energy momentum tensor was, during that epoch, dominated by just radiation, then it was an epoch in which the pressure was a third of the energy density. That's great, because we can take this equation together with those two equations to solve for the three unknown functions. Three equations, three functions. And we will do that later. Or we might also be interested in an epoch of the universe where the universe was not dominated by the radiation that is in there, and by the universe was not dominated, I mean the energy momentum tensor was not dominated by this. And that would be, for example, a phase of the universe a few billion years ago, when the universe was still dense enough so that the matter in it was dominant over the cosmological constant. So like when the universe was like a billion years old. The cosmological constant was presumably there, but the contribution from the energy density of gases and galaxies and so on was presumably dominant. So in that epoch, where the universe is dominated, let's say, by early galaxies, in such an epoch, the galaxies can be described as grains of dust that are forming a pressureless perfect fluid. And therefore, we have that the relationship between pressure and energy density is that no matter what the energy density is, the pressure is zero. And again, for such an epoch, for such a matter-dominated, pure dust epoch, again, we have one equation, two, three, for these three unknowns, and we can calculate what the evolution is. How would we do this? Well, let's start with the Friedmann equation. The Friedmann equation only contains A and rho, but it doesn't contain the pressure, right? Because the Friedmann equation is the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor, so it contains the energy density, but not the pressure, because it only contains T naught naught, not TII. Okay, so here we have already an equation that just relates A and the rho. Maybe there's something we can do. The idea is maybe we can express the energy density as a function of A. Because if we have rho as a function of A, then we can plug that into the Friedmann equation. We can eliminate rho or eliminate A. And but we will eliminate rho then, so that the Friedmann equation becomes just an ordinary differential equation for the A. And then we are in business. Then we can solve that differential equation for A for the various cases, for example, for an energy map for an epoch of the universe when it was cosmological constant dominated, or matter radiation, or let's say radiation dominated, or maybe it was in the form of a dust, where the dust dominated. Oh, we have 1 or 2 minutes. Today I really can't go over time because I have to prepare for a midterm. Okay, so the idea is this. We express rho as a function of A. And how can we do this? Well, it turns out that the Einstein equations, that is to say, g mu nu is 8 pi g t mu nu, implies that equation. So if we put it all together, we can derive this. But what is this? This is a relationship between rho and A. And that's what we want, so that we can then eliminate the rho and end up in the Friedmann equation with an equation only for A. But let's ask, what is this equation? Where does this come from? Is there an intuition for it? Well, let's see. Here we have rho times a to the power 3. Now that looks like a volume here, a growing volume. And you multiply that with the energy density. That's just the energy in a big volume, right? And here we say that d by dA of the energy of a big volume is equal to minus 3, and then you have pressure times a squared. This looks like you have something like a change in volume, change in energy in a volume, and related to pressure. Yes, indeed. That's what it does. Namely, this is the general relativity version of the so-called continuity equation that you may know from fluid mechanics, where if you have a box and the box has a volume which is a to the third, then it has an energy which is energy density times the volume. And you have the continuity equation, which is that the change in energy here, dE, is given by minus the pressure times dV. Right? You squeeze the box, and then that costs energy, or you gain energy, depending on the pressure here. And then if you plug here in, if you plug that in, you obtain that dE is d of a to the third rho. A is the size of the box. The length of the box. So d of a to the third rho is minus p, and then dv is dA to the third, which is minus 3 pressure a squared dA. Divide this equation by a, by d by dA, and you obtain d by dA of a to the third rho is equal to this, which looks the same as that. Of course, it's not a legal calculation here, because this is not gr. But it has an exact match. And it turns out that in general relativity, you can derive that continuity equation as well. It's still true. You just have to do some more work to actually derive it. And I did the work for you. We don't have time to actually go through it in detail. But here's the actual proof within general relativity of that continuity equation. And you find that indeed this is true in general relativity, where A is the scale factor, not the size of a box in R3, but the actual scale factor. And let me just give you the gist of it. The gist of it is that the continuity equation traces back to this equation, right? Which is, if you remember, a consequence. It's a Bianchi identity. It is a consequence of diffeomorphism invariance. And of course, you also need to use what we know about GR and so on. But then you get the continuity equation. OK, but briefly, what benefit do we get? Well, once we have that relationship, we can then go through those various cases and solve the differential equation. So, we had the case where the universe was dominated by a cosmological constant, or by radiation, or by dust, where dust could be a dust, where each grain is a galaxy. And this can be expressed in terms of the W parameter, which is the ratio of pressure divided by energy density, right? The pressure is W times the energy density. We can then solve for the evolution of the scale factor, we can then solve for the energy density as a function of the scale factor, right? We can solve this equation here. And what do we obtain? Well, if we have dust, so if the pressure is equal to zero, then the right-hand side is equal to zero. And therefore, we see right away that rho has to go like 1 over a to the third, because the derivative has to be zero, right? So if there's no pressure, in the case of a dust, what we have is that this is equal to zero. So therefore, this must be a constant. And therefore, rho of a has to be 1 over a to the third. That's super plausible, because what that means is that if you have a dust-dominated universe, then as the universe expands, the energy density of the dust goes down like a to the third power. And that's just dilution, regular dilution. Then for radiation, if you go through the same thing, it's very easy to solve the differential equation. There too, we obtain the relationship of rho as a function of A. Remember, we want that, because once we have rho as a function of A, we can plug that into the Friedmann equation. And then we have that the Friedmann equation will be a function of A only, a differential equation of A, which we will next lecture solve. So we can then get the cosmological solution. But for now, let's just read off what the relationship is of rho as a function of A. And rho in a radiation-dominated universe goes like A to the fourth power, A to the minus fourth power. Why would that be? Any ideas?
Because it gets redshifted.
Yeah, that's right. The photons get diluted, but in addition, they get stretched, right? So it's a dilution gives us a to the minus 3, but also the wavelengths get stretched linearly. That gives us another factor a. OK, and then if it's a purely cosmologically constant dominated universe, then the p is minus rho. Can plug that into here, solve the differential equation, not how, and we find that the rho is a constant in this case, which means that in a cosmological constant dominated universe, the energy density does not dilute. A cosmological constant is super weird, but yeah, it's constant, right? So it's constant in space. Even if the universe expands, the energy density doesn't budge, and neither does the pressure. OK, so what we have now is that for these three cases, which are cosmologically very important, for these three cases, we now have rho expressed as a function of A. This means that in the Friedmann equation, we can go back there. In the Friedmann equation, we will be able to express rho as a function of A. And then we just end up with a differential equation for A, which we can solve. And therefore, for each of these epochs of the universe, we will be able to calculate the a of t, the behavior of the scale factor. OK, so this is as far as we got today. Please, if you have the time, read through that proof to convince yourself that the continuity equation really holds true also in general relativity.